The Slate Political Gabfest is sponsored by Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage using your own computer and printer and save up to 80% compared to a postage meter. Sign up for a no-risk trial and a $110 bonus offer when you visit Stamps.com and use the promo code GABFEST. And by Harry's, the shaving company that offers German-engineered blades, well-designed handles, and shipping right to your door. Visit Harry's.com for $5 off your first purchase with the promo code GABFEST. And by Sundance Now Doc Club, the new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries. Discover unforgettable films like The Queen of Versailles, The Staircase, and The Weather Underground. To get a free 30-day trial, go to docclub.com/gabfest. That's docclub.com/gabfest.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest for July 10th, 2015, the How Many Push-Ups Should the President Be Able to Do edition. I'm David Plotz of Atlas Obscura in Washington, D.C. With me in Washington, D.C., resplendent, is John Dickerson of Face the Nation. Hello, John.
Hey, David. I'm resplendent, but I'm in a constant state of glow because it's 1,000 degrees in Washington always these days.
It is, and it's going to be 2,000 in here. We will be baked. We're not allowed to talk about it. I forgot we're not allowed to talk about how hot it is in the studio. Emily Bazelon, you're somewhere else. Where are you? Hello.
I'm
the
in
New York Times Magazine.
It's quite temperate here. And I'm enjoying – David just shaved his beard off, so I'm getting my first glimpse. David, you are sort of glowing. There's more of your face to glow.
There is. There's more of me. There's more of me to glow. Less of me to love because the hair was really part of me.
And listeners will have an auditory benefit from that as well because there will be no more of that scratching on the microphone.
Yeah. You know. Although I can, that's me rub. That's listeners. That's me rubbing my stubble. On this week's show, we'll have a Dickerson fantasia in the first episode. We're going to talk about polling, presidential polling. This is the one occasion in American history when polling may actually matter, and John is going to revel in it.
Then, because it's going to be wrong.
No, it's not because. Oof, we'll get to it in one second. Then the
Damn,
very interesting Gawker versus Hulk Hogan sex tape trial, which just got postponed. We're going to talk about the First Amendment issues raised by that.
Trialis interruptus.
But not the sex tape. We'll only talk about the First Amendment.
Only the First Amendment. Then what question would you ask a presidential candidate to really get at the soul of that candidate? We are going to talk about that. I realize, John, that, you know, for all of GabFest history, this has been an irrelevant question, but you now actually get to ask these questions.
That's a great question.
Shouted out questions at press conferences.
I know, but it wasn't
before.
He gets a Chris Christie in, but he gets a Rick Perry in.
Yeah, no, it's a good question, and why it's very hard to ask these questions even in that setting is a good
Maybe we'll talk about
that.
Yeah,
we should talk
all
about
that. All right. And then we'll have Cocktail Chatter, and in Slate Plus, we're going to do kind of like a piece of performance art in it. I'm not going to say too much. We're just going to try something. We'll see if it works. If you are not yet a Slate Plus member, you can get it by going to slate.com/GabFestPlus. And believe me, I think based on what might happen, you might want to do it even between the time you start listening to the time of the end of the show. Just a quick note, the Outward folks are Slate's LGBTQ blog. They're doing a live show in New York on, when is it? It's Monday, July 13th. I'm going to go at City Winery in New York City. And with Brian Lauder, Mark Stern, and June Thomas, who are fantastic. And they have special guests, Evan Wolfson, the attorney who built the marriage equality cases, and Ted Allen of the Food Network's Chopped and All-Star Academy and Queer Eye for the Straight Guy will be there. It's going to be really fun. They're all really fun and smart and interesting, and you should go. You can get tickets at slate.com/NYC Outward, and Slate Plus members get 30% off their ticket price. Polling, not just a John Dickerson obsession this month. Polls actually matter. The reason polls actually matter, John, is because on August 6th and September 16th, the Fox and CNN debates, the Republican presidential debates, will have 10 candidates, and which candidates get to be in those debates, because there are 16 or so declared Republican presidential candidates or semi-declared Republican presidential candidates, which candidates get to be is based on the results of polls. So this is no problem for your Jeb Bushes and your Marco Rubios and probably your Donald Trumps, but for others. It's a big problem. So John, start us off. What is the methodology insofar as we know it? Because there's still some opacity about it.
Are they still doing like table one and table two?
They are. I mean, the first point is that America has always had a strong relationship with the Polish people. And so
we have a Polish au pair right now.
Do you?
Yeah. She's so great. I love the Polish people now that we have a Polish au pair.
Isn't some part of your family from Poland?
Well, yes. Yeah, but that was the bad part.
Yeah, this is the bad part.
Well, this is like back when it was bad. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, I know.
Can we go on to the subject? John's joke. Feeble joke.
That is the best conversation that's been launched out of a horrible dad joke in a long time. Okay. So what's happening? Well, here's the problem. Let's step back even further. Is that the Republican Party decided that there were 26 or so debates in the last presidential campaign, and that it was a mess. It turned out to be unwieldy. They ceded the donors to the party. This is a crucial point. The donors to the party went to the party chairman and said, "You had all these debates, and you ceded control over the message of our party to all these television networks. And the television networks only care about promoting their anchors who host these debates. And so they turn them into these circus events where questions have nothing to do with what Republican primary voters care about. And they're only used to promote what the television stations want or the broadcast networks want." So they said, "You got to fix this." So the Republican Party said, "Okay, we're going to fix it. We're going to limit the number of debates." So once they limited the number of debates, there are now 9 debates through March 1st. And the reason that kind of matters is that the other problem is that there are 9 debates but 16 or so candidates. If there were 26 different debates, you could imagine different configurations to accommodate this greater number. But since there are a smaller number of debates, they all matter more. So there's a debate on the 6th of April. Sorry, strike that. There's a debate on the 6th of August, but then the next one's not till
September 16th.
So you got a long time to wait before you can get your crack at it again. So it really matters if you're in that top 10. The way it's CNN and Fox are going to do it is they'll take the average of 5 polls before. I think the Fox cutoff is the 4th or 5th of August. And then that's interesting because what happens if a poll comes out on the 5th? All the polling institutions, though, know this, and they're going to get their polls out. But basically, it's the average at the 4th or 5th of August, and the top 10 will be picked out of that. But what happens if number 9 and 10 are super, super close in that average? If you're on that bubble, it'll be up to Fox and CNN. They'll have 2 tables. One will be the top 10, and then the second table will be the kiddies table, and that'll be numbers 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16.
But the second table isn't actually at the debate. They do a forum early in the day.
Yeah.
1 o'clock or something.
At CNN, I believe they are at the – I think it's the same venue. Uh-huh. And CNN, we can talk about this later. It's interesting. They're going to have the B debate, which is to say 11 through 16, before the 1 through 10. And I think that creates some interesting conditions, which we can talk about.
But this is an occasion – because normally polling is simply something you do for informational purposes, and it's something to know about what's going on and to bring pleasure to journalists. This is a case where literally the polling is determining a significant element of this race.
Right. And that's a choice that the networks made, not the RNC made, in part because the RNC, while wanting to limit the number of debates, they wanted to leave their hands clean of the actual who gets on and who doesn't get on because they didn't want to look like they were picking winners and losers. But the fact of the matter is you can't have, even with 10 people on the stage, the most anybody is going to get is 5 minutes. And so imagine what it would be like if you had 16.
I can't really imagine another way that they could have done it.
We talked about this before where we tried to think of a better methodology, and it's very hard to think of it unless you do something where you say we're just going to have round robin, we're going to have 4, you know, we're going to pick everyone out of a grab bag. We'll do over 4 nights, we'll do 4 different debates, each with 4 candidates. I don't know why they didn't try something like that. That seems to me like a better method.
More clever. I think the problem is you get – so if you did it over 4 nights,
or
would
two
that be
nights
considered
where you do
one
four,
debate?
Or you do two nights. Each night you
nobody
have two
would
sets
listen
of 4.
To all of those things.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, really, you want to get
like
your most biggest bang for the buck.
In the second week of August, I feel like the viewership for the last one would be extremely low.
I don't know. But don't you think this format, John, it's so deadly?
Yeah. Oh, it's totally deadly for everybody. And then the question is, what's your strategy as a candidate? And each candidate will have different strategies. If you're Ted Cruz, everybody's expecting you to be the debate master, right? But you can't be the master of a debate if you have only 4 minutes to talk, right? And so how do you deal with those expectations? Same with Chris Christie. You know, he's got a really short window. If he wants to show that he's like Mr. Charismatic person, hard to do if it doesn't kind of come your way. And so it could be among the dullest debates ever in the history of mankind, because it'll be just 10 speeches given right next to each other.
Do you think, Emily, they're going to have to rig it so that Carly Fiorina gets in the debates?
Oh, because she's the only woman.
She's the only woman running.
I don't think they can rig it. I mean, the polls are the polls. They have a fair, agreed-upon method. How are they supposed to rig it?
Well, yeah. No, I think that's right. Or it'll look, you know, everybody will call them out. The other interesting question is, I think the Fox rules allow them to shrink from 10 to 8.
Which maybe they should.
You know, in other words, so, but then who? Then the people, then you really
then
put
nine,
focus
you're
on
9
eight,
and 10.
9 and 10, you're
right.
Killing them.
They'll
you're killing
furious.
Them.
It would be better, also, though, if it was 8 and 8
it's not just
of 10
that.
And 6.
And there's a Trump question. I mean, there's a...
What's the Trump question? He's by what standard will he not be able to participate?
Well, that's, I mean, he's going to be on the stage, which for the broadcast networks
is great
news, right? It's going to get all kinds of people watching the car crash. But not great for the party.
I feel like the Republicans have this wonderful opportunity to have a really great presidential primary campaign because they have smart candidates and they have candidates who disagree about things and they're high stakes. And they're not going to be able to do it because their debate format is terrible and because Trump is in the field. And
well,
so
it'll be interesting in 6 or 9 months to think about the lessons for the RNC and the party about how they could reorganize the primaries the next time around, because this can't be the desired outcome to have 16 people and this fighting for airtime at the debates. That just seems.
But Emily, will they all wash out by? Is it, or John? Maybe this is a question for you. So, when's New Hampshire and Iowa? When are they?
February and February.
So we'll
I mean, like
Hampshire
the first and
Iowa,
12th. Hold on, let's just.
Are we going to wash out to 3?
No. No, you're not going to wash out because everybody's got super PACs
funding.
And money, and also some of them have their own base of support. You know, so on Thursday, Bush announced that he had raised $103 million from his super PAC, and then I think 11 of his regular money. Cruz has raised $58 million in his, or no, 58, 50 total, $38 million in his super PAC and the rest in campaign money. So those guys are going to be around. Rand Paul will be around because he just can live off, you know, his supporters and the land. And Cruz and Rubio and Walker will be around. So you'll have a lot of people with money to stick around.
What's the number that would be a good number for the party, for the Democratic process after Iowa and New Hampshire?
That's a great question.
Six? Eight?
Well, I think,
four?
I think 4 to 6.
4 to 6 seems right to me, too.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it just gets too confusing. And that's like a lot of choices still.
The New Hampshire primary is the 9th, and the Iowa caucuses are the 1st. So I was pretty close.
If you're not in the 10 for the debate, are you totally hosed, Emily?
I feel like the bottom 6, they're pretty – but I don't know if it's because of the debate that they're hosed. I mean, I suppose you could argue that this is creating 2 classes of candidates, and then to make the jump into the first class would be really hard. But aren't you hosed because your poll numbers are really low? I mean, what percentage are you going to have to not be included in the top 10? 2%?
John, who's not going to be in it? So you
Carly Fiorina may not
be in it. Well, so Bush, Trump, Rubio, Walker – Paul and Carson.
Cruz.
Right, are
Cruz, yeah.
And Cruz, are those are 7. That's
yeah, probably Perry. Perry probably makes
Perry
it.
Perry makes it.
And
he's
then
8.
Who's left? Then Huckabee
makes it.
Huckabee would be 9. Then it's like Kasich, Jindal, Graham, Fiorina, Christie. We didn't even
Christie probably makes it. He's, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Because part of the
no
name
Kasich,
recognition.
No,
I think at where we are right now, I don't think Kasich makes it. Now, of course, here's the interesting thing. Kasich hasn't officially announced. So he will officially announce not next week, but the week after. So his announcement and the bump almost everybody gets from their announcement will happen in the polling cycle or closer to the polling cycle that will determine who gets on stage. So
surely that was on purpose.
Well, I think it must have been, yes. Now, we should say one other thing is that if you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, you have, as Emily was saying, you're hosed in part because of where you are in the polling. And that matters not just because it means voters aren't attracted to you yet. that doesn't matter. As we know, voters are in a very shopping, sloshy mood. They're going to move around. But it means you probably haven't been able to raise a lot of money. And the reason you need the money is not only to compete with these other fellows. The reason you need money is not only to survive after you lose the first caucuses or primary. The reason you need money is you got to stay in this thing long, because this is going to go on for a while, because the money the other guys have means that they're building infrastructure and they're going to be around, you know, into April. And so in the old days, the idea was you organize and then you get hot and then you kind of, you know, in 1992, Bill Clinton comes in second in New Hampshire and the rest of the field is essentially cleared. It becomes a two-man race, him and Tsongas. So he can recoup against Tsongas and then he has a little threat from Jerry Brown, but it winnows quickly. If you get hot now, you're fighting like four people, five people, and they all have organizations in these other states. So it's almost impossible to imagine a situation where somebody gets a boatload of money and can instantly, after doing well in one of those first four contests, say, convert that boatload of money right into organization and signs and field operations and all that stuff. That stuff takes a while to build. So you so it's like getting, you know, finding oil in your backyard. You know, if you don't have the rig to capture it, it just kind of spews out and melts back into the ground.
Given that you need to do well in the polls to get into the debate, for the 7 to 16 folks, doesn't that mean that we're going to see in the next month just some crazy stuff, Emily? Aren't they going to be doing some just bananas kinds of publicity hawking? Sort of what Trump – basically, it's all now – Trump has gotten 99% of the coverage of this. But shouldn't Ted Cruz be trumping? Shouldn't Christie be trumping?
Yeah,
shouldn't
let's
Bobby
turn
Jindal
it into
be trumping?
A verb.
No, wait. You've just come up with a term
yes.
of art.
Yeah. Let's
That's
be
fantastic.
Trumping. Always be trumping.
Yes. I think you're right. Those three, and I'm sure you could add to the list, do have an incentive to start trumping. And not only because the math would have led them in that direction anyway, but because Trump has done it to such a successful degree in terms of his jump in the polls, which is, of course, we should just say, abhorrent given what he's been saying. But so it goes.
Yeah, I think that will cause people to act out. The question then is, can you act out in a sufficient way that it gives you the spike you need at the right time the polls are being taken and that can sustain you over that period of time that the polls are being taken? And one other methodological thing to throw in there that I think is worth thinking through and is interesting to me is what will...
When John says interesting to me,
yeah,
that's
it's exactly,
the signal for you guys just to tune out for like 3 minutes.
Everybody's
we'll call back.
Yeah,
we'll call you back.
Disagree.
Like, sweet,
I was on the edge of my seat.
I needed to change the bag in the vacuum cleaner.
Right. Like, what do you think people do at that moment? Like, what is their... You think they pour themselves another cup of tea? Do you think they,
they just check out.
So what you're saying is that like people are checking out, looking at nature or whatever.
Run half a mile now, third of a mile.
So I've helped people have a greater appreciation for the beauty around them by saying that I find something interesting and therefore setting them into a quiet little lope of repose. What I find interesting is what the screen is going to be. So let's say the New York Times and CBS do a poll and they say, this is a horse race poll of all Republicans, but is it registered Republicans? Is it likely to vote Republicans? Is it likely to vote Republicans in caucuses and primary states?
What should it be, John?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, I think it should be registered Republicans.
It should be registered. We're populist. We want the broadest.
Oh yeah,
possible.
Yeah. Oh, and also for the purposes of just general, you know. But on the other hand, why not make it all voters? I mean, in other words, if you chose between registered now, all voters can't participate.
Primary.
Well, but in some places, all voters can sign up.
In some places, but that's not the norm across the country. Those states are outliers.
So. Yeah.
The Republicans, when they assign the debates to the networks. So you're saying that decision is wholly up to the network.
Yeah, exactly. And also
so they
it's apples
say
and
it's
oranges.
Just, you know, it's based on our poll of Democrats, if they want.
Yeah, right, or our poll of family members. No, well, in figuring out the averages, because not all of the methodology of the individual polls that they're averaging will be the same. And
oh
so now, one could imagine a situation in which Fox and or CNN has gotten in touch with the polling operations. Although in the clips that I read, they said they hadn't been contacted because maybe then in that case it would skew. Because you could imagine a candidate at number 11 saying, hey, screw you. You got in touch with these polling operations and told them all to do registered Republicans. But if some of them had done caucus goers or likely voters, I would have gotten in because
yeah,
the likely voters.
Yeah, but what does that get you? Just sour grapes.
Well, that's what somebody that's a great point, Emily. A Republican Party person I was talking to said, you know, the problem with all the carping about people getting in or out of the debates is they basically look like losers.
And yeah, they look marginal. I want to ask a question about the broader crisis in polling that I have been reading about, and I bet you guys have been reading about too. So polls are less accurate because people don't answer their phone anymore, and so the response rates are lower, and also because pollsters aren't very good at calling cell phones. It's expensive to call cell phones. We're all more protected from random calls on our cell phones. And so the polls have been completely off recently. I guess they weren't there. They were like not, they were off a little bit in the last federal American election, but they were really off in Israel, in Greece, in the UK, right? So this is, seems like a big deal to me that elections become more unpredictable and we're just not as sure of where we're heading. As part of me likes the way in which it sort of throws everything up into the air and means that there is a less solid conventional wisdom. But I don't know. There must be a downside. John, our resident polling guru.
Wait, can I?
David Plunk.
No, I want to weigh into here.
Weigh in.
So, okay. Emily, yes, it's true. At the same time, we've had this tremendous rise in methodological rigor and in kind of meta-polling. So you have the Nate Silver, obviously, being the number one example of it. But there's a huge recognition that, first of all, any single poll doesn't mean anything, that you have to look at whole batches of polls. And my sense is that for those people who think about this seriously and who say, like, let's look at the whole sweep of what polls there are and try to get large sample sizes, large number samples of polls, that actually there's no crisis. That it's,
oh,
you know,
I don't think that's true at all. And I'm going to invoke Nate because he was writing something last week about this problem of herding, where polls that are outliers that would change. This happened in Britain and in Israel. There were polls before those elections that predicted the results more accurately than most of the other polls. And those polls, the companies thought they were outliers and didn't publish them. So I don't think it's true that we have necessarily a future of robust polling in which, oh, the problems just sort of wash out because there are lots of
people doing
this.
I don't know. People seem like a lot smarter about polling. John, you just did a podcast about the 1948 presidential election. That's a presidential election in relatively recent history where the entire class of polling and punditry is completely wrong.
Like, yes, but like the point is, are we returning to something like that? Because we did not have that for the last 15 to 20 years. It's not like we've always had accurate polls, but I got used to that idea that they were going to be basically right.
Well, I have a series of things that come to mind. In the last presidential election, what the Obama people make a pretty good case for how their polls were right. In other words, it wasn't the methodology of the collection of the data that was wrong. It was their understanding of the numbers they got in, how they could read them, and what they told them about the larger electorate. Because there are two problems. There's the information you get in from your collection scheme, whatever it may be, cell phones, phone conversations, knocking on doors. And then there is how you interpret that. So the guess you make about the shape of the electorate and what it's going to look like, and then how you meld those two things together and come up with a number and whether that's representative of who turns out on election day. The Obama people used a series of different methods for that. They did a lot of their own polling, which so they, you know, were able to ask the questions in the way they thought was methodologically best. They blew off a lot of the junk polls which are out there, which is something we all have to be more educated about in terms of what makes a good poll and what makes a crappy poll. And then they used massive sort of loose focus groups to test. I mean, they did a lot of things. But anyway, this is another thing they did, was use massive loose focus groups to find out whether some of the stuff they were hearing in public polls made any sense in terms of just like their own kind of fingertip feel of things. And so through a series, and then they, of course, had a massively targeted group of specific voters so that if a poll said, you know, you're really weak with this kind of voter, they could say, well, you know, we've got a gargantuan list of just that kind of voter and we've been in regular touch with them. And we know in some of these early voting states that those voters are really already voting. So we have a better understanding. So the condition that may suggest is that the campaigns will have a pretty good understanding if they do it right of what's going on, but that the media organizations that put out all these public polls don't have the money, the time, and the attention to put to those kind of surveys. And so I'm trying to think through what that kind of disconnect will create. Having said that, there was obviously a disconnect between the Romney campaign, which thought the
and
polls
reality.
Were different, and reality. So I don't know. And one other final point is campaigns are now becoming, through the use of targeting, getting a really good idea of the size of the electorate and the shape of the electorate that they got to go after, because, you know, it's narrowed down to 8 to 11 swing states, and then it's narrowed down to certain neighborhoods, and they basically know the names of everybody in those neighborhoods and will by this election cycle. So, you know, they're going to get down to the to a situation where they really have a very close sense of how an election is going to go, because they basically have everybody's name in there.
I wonder if anyone in the, who's listening to the GabFest is one of those people. I mean, surely, yes.
Oh.
But I'd love to get a, those people, because I don't get any political. I live in D.C. It's, there's nothing going to happen. I never get any political mailing. I'd love to see if you're that person, what you're getting day after day.
Well, you know, I talked to one of the people who's running, one of the candidates who's running in the Republican field, and they said that they, on the announcement letter that they sent out when they announced their campaign, that they sent out over 100 different variations of that letter to, based on different targeting and also based to kind of tickle responses to see, hey, is this person, does this person care about education because they care K through 12, or they care about education 0 to 5, or they care about education for college loans? And once you start figuring out, if once you get a ping back from an email you've sent to somebody that they care about college loans, then you can serve them a new thing. And so I guess my point is that the people, we could have 1,000 people getting surveyed in our listenership, and they would all feel like they were getting a different piece of the elephant.
Yeah, that's a sponsor this week by Stamps.com. Getting your mailing and shipping done can seem like a no-win situation, sort of like it's going to be for 15 Republican presidential candidates. Ba-dum-bum. Going to the post office takes up valuable time. Leasing a postage meter is expensive. It has multi-year commitments and hidden fees. But there's a better way, which is Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package right from your desk using your own computer and printer, and get special postage discounts you can't find at the post office. Plus, Stamps.com is more powerful than a postage meter at just a fraction of the cost. You can save up to 80% compared to a postage meter and avoid those time-consuming trips to the post office. Right now, our promo code GABFEST gets you a special offer, a no-risk trial, and a $110 bonus offer, which includes, of course, a free digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. For all the details of the special offer and to sign up today, go to stamps.com. Before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in GABFEST. That's stamps.com. Enter GABFEST. The Gawker versus Hulk Hogan sex tape trial was delayed this week. It was supposed to start on July 6th in Florida, but it was pushed back indefinitely for the moment because the judge allegedly, according to Gawker's claim, which was supported by a more superior judge, didn't give adequate breathing space between time when all the filings were supposed to be submitted and the start of the trial. The delay is believed to help Gawker, which is gathering other evidence in the meantime. The case is a pretty confusing one. It's about a sex tape made possibly without Hulk Hogan's consent.
Of, so he says.
Of Hulk Hogan having sex with the then wife of Hogan's great friend, Bubba the Love Sponge, who's a DJ. And Gawker obtained this tape, cut a very long 2-hour sex tape down to 90 seconds.
Yeah.
Aired it with some written commentary and basically made claimed
aired
that
it with a 1,400-word blow-by-blow of the sex.
Yeah, and sort of an attempt to justify it. It's
look,
newsworthy.
If we're
going to
keep creating these conditions for childish comments by me, I'm going to have to bow out.
The blow-by-blow? So Hogan has now sued Gawker. He sued Gawker a while ago for invasion of privacy, and he's seeking $100 million in damages. There's a lot of interesting legal issues. First, two disclosures. One is which that the wife of one of our colleagues, Dan Coyce at Slate, is the lawyer for Gawker.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And and then one of the defendants at Gawker, one of the people who was heavily involved in this, is John Cook, who's the husband of another Slate colleague of ours, Allison Benedict. So we have two connections on the Gawker side, but nobody on Hulk Hogan's side. But John Dickerson wrestled with Hulk Hogan back
and
in the day.
And Allison and Dan have a podcast.
Yes. They also have a podcast together.
About sex tapes and the law,
exactly.
Which is really, really a coincidence.
So, Emily, why? What are the legal issues here for that allowed Hogan to file a lawsuit, and what is Gawker claiming in its defense?
Well, the main claim here is a libel claim. Hogan also claims that his likenesses being used without his permission. That's a sort of subsidiary damages claim. He's not likely to win that, and I don't think he's going to win at all. He certainly shouldn't win. I'll just lay my cards out in the out there from the start. But just to take care of this idea of your likeness being used without your permission, if Gawker was a for-profit company, i.e. a pornography film company, and they had used this film without someone's permission and made a lot of money off of it, then he could have a valid claim that his likeness is being used for commercial purposes without his permission, and you're not allowed to make money off of someone's sex tape or, you know, video of something else without them being able to get a cut. But that's not what happened here. Gawker, as you said, edited down this tape and put it out there in a newsworthy way. And I think there are two points of real legal vulnerability for Hogan. One is that he's so clearly a public figure. He absolutely is someone who gets less protection from libel law because he is a public figure.
This is not a libel claim. Not a libel.
I know, but it still matters in terms of thinking about how he's positioned here, right? And then the other thing is that he himself has made his sex life a big part of his own notoriety. He's talked about it. He's put it out there for public consumption. And so then to say that you don't want this particular aspect or glimpse into your sex life revealed and that you've been damaged to the tune of $100 million by this revelation seems really implausible.
If there were a sex tape floating around of me,
you would have a better claim. Not well, much,
under
though.
What circumstances?
Not if you get rid of
under
that beard.
What,
you
under what circumstances? Under what circumstances is that invasion of privacy? Under what circumstances is that news?
If, you know, there was a sex tape of you and it was linked in some way to something you had talked or written about or your status as Slate's publisher. I mean, you're not Slate's publisher. Sorry.
I'm never Slate's publisher.
I know.
I'm definitely not Slate's
publisher
now.
Wrong in five ways. Your status is the CEO of Atlas Obscura and you might get fired for the production of this videotape or it's somehow linked to your work in some way. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they could pull in that great video that you and Hannah did of being on a rope together and say there was some connection because you had put your marital relationship out into the public sphere, then that again would be something that the courts would and should look at. On the other hand, you know, if you are not, you're a completely private figure and someone puts a sex tape of you up there and they don't do anything to make it newsworthy, then that is somewhere else on the scale. So, you know, that's those are the sort of competing balance tests that courts do in these situations. And, you know, the problem for Hulk Hogan is like, okay, on the one hand, the idea that someone could take a video that you say was made without your consent and it's of your most intimate act and put it out there on the internet seems like there's something wrong with that. On the other hand, I would say that maybe the celebrity who is the least well positioned to complain about that might be Hulk Hogan. Because he has made his sex life so much a part of his appeal, it just doesn't compute. And particularly the damage claim part of it doesn't compute, right? You could imagine a jury finding for him and then awarding right. him a dollar.
Yeah. So let's expand a hypothetical. So what if you were a porn star? Could you ever construct an argument that a sex tape of a porn star made without their consent that they would have a claim against the person who made and published it without their consent? I guess you could have a professional claim.
Well
would you have more of a professional claim because they're stealing
your... The other person in the sex tape might have a claim.
If they weren't a porn star.
Yeah.
I think it's hard to win as a porn star. As long as someone does something
that
makes it
newsworthy.
Ain't
that the truth in so many ways.
It's right. I mean, it's the newsworthiness test. And I mean, I thought that the Gawker post about this tape totally passed the newsworthy test. There was commentary about it. It wasn't like the most earth-shattering article read, but, you know. Well,
I mean, Emily, this isn't, as with so many First Amendment kinds of cases, it's slightly, you know, stinks of the garbage can, right?
Well,
you
it's don't, a lot like the, right, like, yeah. It's
you know,
a
it
lot
doesn't,
like,
it's not moral to do what they did. It seems like it's newsworthy, but like, let's
no,
not kid
not
ourselves.
Moral.
This is noble.
Right,
I mean, I do actually think,
this
although,
is where
wait.
Press freedom gets defended, right? And this is Gawker has been making this point, and I think they're right.
Yeah, and I actually think in Gawker's defense, although I think this is an extreme and kind of grotesque example of it, that they have a mission to say that celebrities have tried to have it one way, which is that they want to have all the benefits of being able to market themselves and create images for themselves and control that and squash the truth about them. And Gawker is saying, you know what? We refuse to play with that. We're going to be truth tellers about celebrities who refuse to let the truth be told about them. And we're going to do it even when it's really gross and disgusting. And I think the larger cause is a pretty good one because so many people in the public eye want to get all the benefits of being in the public eye, all the benefits of money and fame and praise, but are unwilling to deal with the consequences, which is that you just have to take it a little bit, too.
Right. I mean, I think we should point out, to be fair, that one of the problems here is, I mean, Gawker made money from this tape in some way, shape, or form. There have been something like 5 million page views of the story that they put up, even though they have had to take the actual tape down in the course of this litigation. And so the notion that there's something so totally separate about a news organization posting a tape like this as opposed to, you know, a pornography site, it's not as if the news site isn't also benefiting commercially. That I think we need to get that out on the table because it seems like it's part of why this is confusing and feels not just sordid, but also complicated.
Also, why does Gawker get to be the moral balancer of the celebrity who gets all this benefit from being in the public eye? Why is it their role to like balance that out?
It seems to me so often that celebrities are bullying and demanding and pushy and control how they're covered. Like they, you know, if they're going to be written about by a magazine, they'll insist that only subjects not be discussed. And Gawker is saying they won't play with that.
But they're saying that broadly with all celebrities, or are they saying it just about this one?
This is how they live.
Yeah.
So if they had a sex tape of the most noble, good-hearted celebrity, they would feel compelled just as quickly to make as much money.
I think they would. Yeah.
Yeah, I think they probably would. I mean, that's their place in the – not that they're the only one standing there, but that is a niche they occupy in the universe of the internet and the press in general, is to be completely non-deferential to celebrities. And I agree with you, David. I think there is good to be – absolutely. Like, that is an important stance for them to take.
And what are the other – thing that they are unusual and that they're incredibly aggressive about standing up against lawsuit threats, which very few other places are. I know,
right,
having been on the other side of this, it is so much easier. I'm a total coward.
It's so much
easier to take it down. It's so much easier not to deal with a threat and the anxiety of it, even though it's almost impossible to win a lawsuit against a place like Slate or Gawker.
Right, but
really,
the litigation itself is tremendously costly dealing with it. And then the other thing is, I mean, this isn't always true, but often when someone brings a libel claim, even if they're not going to win in court, and even if you feel as the press outlet in the right, you might not feel like 110% in the right. There might be something that makes you feel slightly uncomfortable with your own position in a way that would make you think, like, is it really going to harm anyone to take this down? Is this like a Pulitzer Prize winning piece of journalism?
Right.
And
right,
that is like a problem because the more the press caves, the more people demand, often on copyright bases.
Yeah, and you've made a mistake. In my experience, like the times, and I am not proud of my own record on this. As editor of Slate, it's like you know, we've definitely made a mistake. Now, the mistake, does it justify pulling the thing down? Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But it's you're never pure as a driven snow as the defendant. The other thing that's so pernicious about this particular case and why it's really interesting, because legally it seems pretty clear that Gawker is going to win in the end, it's highly unlikely that even if the jury finds against Gawker, that in the long run the federal court –
on appeal, they should win.
On appeal, they're going to win. And whatever the state appeals court ever gets up to the Supreme Court, they're going to win. It meets whatever the newsworthiness standard is. However, Florida law is such that if Gawker loses, they have to post the bond. They have to pay the damages right up front,
which they don't have the money for. Although they're not going to get these damages. I mean, let's just make clear again. The jury could find for Hogan and award him little or no money. And in some ways, that might be an okay outcome in the sense that it would recognize that, you know, of course his privacy was invaded. He's a celebrity. We can argue that he didn't really have any privacy to invade, or given the way he was, all the points we've been making, it shouldn't really count. And that's what I would argue for. But, you know, if you are concerned about invasion of privacy and that's a legitimate thing to worry about, then finding for him, but recognizing that, I mean, how has he suffered from this? It's just really hard to see. Certainly it's his career hasn't suffered as a result of it.
You can make just the opposite claim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, people haven't been talking about Hulk Hogan a lot.
Many of us might have forgotten who he was. I certainly had only
no. Once you've heard the name Hulk Hogan and seen him,
you would never forget.
He's like Mr. T.
I really knew he was a wrestler as opposed to some other. I don't know. I don't know if I could have pinned it down before.
One final point I want to make is that I think we're at an interesting moment, which is that I think news organizations are caving and are cowardly and are being threatened by, particularly by celebrities, all the time, and are giving up and conceding and pulling things down and retreating and unwilling to sort of stand up. Gawker's unusual in that way. I think that one thing is happening. At the same time, so much more information is sieving out into the world that even though in any given case a news organization is likely to fold and to capitulate and to pull down whatever it is, in general, there is just vastly more information and derogatory information that tends to flow out into the world all the time because there's so many outlets and because so many people feel unconstrained. So it's a weird kind of dual moment. We'll leave
True.
It there.
Yeah.
We will
Good
leave
point.
It there. Okay.
We agree.
The Gabfest has a very apropos sponsor this week, which is Harry's.com. Harry's.
Did you use your Harry's razor to shave off your beard?
I sure did. Well, I shaved off. Let's talk
use
about
the Black
shaved,
and Decker
I shaved,
first.
I shaved off the majority of the beard with my clippers, and then I used Harry's to do my shave. I had a full shave for the first time in months. It was delightful with my orange Harry's razor. It was really and Harry's shave cream. It was incredibly pleasurable. Harry's, of course, is the company that gives you a superior shave, great blades. They bought a razor blade factory in Germany. And they're offering an amazing shave at a fraction of the price. And they have great products to go along with your razor and your razor handle, including shave cream and shave gel. I prefer the cream, but maybe I'll try the gel. I don't know. And they have a starter set that's just $15, which includes the razor, three blades, and your choice of shave cream or foaming shave gel. And as an added bonus, you can get $5 off your first purchase with our promo code GABFEST. Which means you can get an entire month's worth of shaving for just $10, and shipping is always free. So go to harrys.com now, and Harry's will give you $5 off if you type in our code GABFEST with your first purchase. That's HARRYS.com, and enter coupon code GABFEST at checkout for $5 off the starter set. And start shaving smarter today. Get rid of your beard like I did. We now turn to another Dickersonian topic. We were just thinking about what we wanted to talk about today and just batting around ideas. And John, who has had the occasion to ask presidents and presidential candidates many, many questions, said, you know, what is it that we really want to ask them? What is it that we want to know from them? How can we extract that information and why? So we thought we'd talk a little bit about what it is that we think presidential – is it presidential candidates or presidents? Candidates?
Well, I mean
candidates,
they're related,
right?
But I think candidates.
Okay, candidates. What do we want to know from them and about them that we're not learning? So, John, this is your baby. You actually ask presidential candidates questions all the time. So what is it that you want to get at here?
Yeah, the big thing I want to get at is whether they have any of the skills that they're going to actually need for the job. And whether they've experienced anything in their lives that might be a direct help for them in that job. And then examine the underlying theory behind this, which is that you can tell, like, that this will give us any better indication whether they'll be a success in an office or not. I would argue, just branching off from that question, that in my view, it doesn't matter, because this is an interesting conversation. I think if you have the conversation about the attributes presidents are required to have, then you gain a better understanding of the presidency, and that's good for everyone. So I think these questions are important, even if they don't actually lead to better choices in our presidency. And also, by the way, we should talk about, since this podcast is now going to go into breakfast with all these questions, whether people actually care about any of this stuff, which the short answer is they don't.
What is an example, Emily, of a question that you would like a presidential candidate to answer?
Well, there are at least two different kinds of questions. One are the questions that are trying to get at generalities, right? You know, like John's question, what was a mistake you made? What did you learn from it? Things that are drawing on your life experience. What books have you read? The trying to find out basically, like, who are you? What are your priors, to use the legal word, the background, the cultural sensibilities, the experiences you've had that really shape who you are. And then there are the questions about particular policy issues or events. How would you handle this? What do you think about that? I mean, we just had a whole round of this with gay marriage, which I think was actually a pretty useful and interesting moment for gauging different Republicans' stances on this rapidly changing social phenomenon that was uncomfortable for a lot of them, but they had to react to it. And there was some daylight among the candidates in terms of how they responded. So it does seem like, or the Confederate flag is another pretty telling moment where if you can pick an event or a question about policy that has drama behind it and is changing in some way so that the answer isn't obvious anymore, or the answer that one particular ideological stance would lead you to isn't obvious anymore. Those seem like really useful moments.
But well, can we think of a single example? And John, to your credit, the only one I can think of is you with George W. Bush, where that question has revealed something. Not the stumping. I mean, it was a stumping of the thumping. But where it revealed something tremendous about him, like that we realized all of a sudden, oh, my God, this is a man without self-doubt, perhaps. So when, John, you asked him, you remember, I'm sure, better than I do. But
So I asked him, I said, you've talked about, he used to joke during the campaign that getting rid of Sammy Sosa was the biggest mistake he ever made. So I said, you've talked about that issue before. So what's the biggest mistake you've made as president and what have you learned from it? The thing is, where that question came from is where this whole set of like this obsession has come from, is talking to my brother and my stepfather, who are both like businessmen. And, the whole theory of the business world, and this was however many years ago, but it's even more in vogue today, is that you fail quickly and that failure is not to be – that failure is a good thing because it means you're taking risks, you're taking challenges, and that your ability to learn quickly from failures is what separates the mediocre from the great. And so we in politics are never – nobody's ever allowed to make a mistake. Nope, can't do it. And you're never allowed to admit one. Can't do it. And yet, of course, they all make mistakes, which is why, again, I think recognizing the fact that presidents make mistakes and that what we should care about is not the mistakes they've made, but their ability to learn from them quickly and adapt, which later, George Bush, you can make a case in terms of the surge in Iraq, adapted to mistakes he had made, that the entire surge strategy that Petraeus put in place was a retooling of the adventure in Iraq based on mistake learning. And you can go on down a big road about that. But anyway, that's what I was trying to get at. I wasn't trying to, have it turn into the thing that it turned into. But
can you guys think of any question which a president has been asked or a presidential candidate and it gave you insight that was useful?
Well, another one along these lines is when Roger Mudd asked Teddy Kennedy why he wanted to be president. And it would serve two purposes. One, people had said, Teddy Kennedy just thinks he's the next in line. And so when Kennedy couldn't answer that question very well, it reaffirmed what people already thought, which was that he was kind of, just thought, well, I'm next in line and I'll just kind of waltz into the nomination. You remember that was a claim against Hillary Clinton in 2016. And that's why she used to say before she declared her candidacy that the real question she was trying to answer was why she wanted to run. So she was putting it up there front and center and saying, I will have an answer to this question. Anyway, in his answer, it was clear that he hadn't really thought through why he wanted to be president. And that if you don't have like a guiding intent for your candidacy, that's not good for the people who are trying to rally behind it, but also for why you want the job and what you want to do with it. I mean, some of the versions of these questions that I've wanted to ask over the years, but you never get good answers. And I think, Emily, you put it perfectly. On the second sort of policy-related issues, I'd love it if we could break the lock on hypothetical questions and mm-hmm. get candidates to actually answer hypotheticals, because then they can answer the policy questions you're asking, but in a more complete way. So in other words, not should the flag come up or should the flag come down, but how would you, not just how would you vote, but how would you, what arguments would you use to convince the six lawmakers you need to convince to bring that flag down or whatever, just some like word problems that would show their brain working, show, how they read a political landscape and then apply their talents to the problem that they, you define your solution to a problem in a lot of ways by defining the battlefield, defining what it should be fought on. And so in getting somebody to think hypothetically, you see not only how their mind works, but how they take a problem and choose to attack it. And that just tells us more about a president than all the other crazy stuff we ask them about. It just seems to me would be a more interesting way. It would be a way to make the process more interesting.
One, this is totally random, but one that I would just be curious, and maybe you can pull this off, John, but they'll never let you do it. is you go to your interview with whoever it is, Bobby Jindal, and you have a big piece of kale in a tooth. And just see what he does.
Yeah.
See if he pretends, if he, like, politely points to how he handles that.
Right, right. So
is there a right answer to that scenario?
I don't know.
No,
I don't know. It'd be awesome, though. It's like it's sort of Ali G.
Yeah.
The problem.
Right, right. Yeah, it's a little stunt.
I think one question I've always, I mean, it seems to me, what do you guys think? So I've always thought it would be useful to ask a candidate, what's the biggest crisis you faced and how did you handle it? Because when you get into the presidency, you're going to face a crisis pretty fast, whether it's public like the Bay of Pigs or the shooting down of the EP spy plane for George Bush, or whether it's private like what, you know, the briefing Obama got about how the economy was about to like turn into a black hole the day after he came into office. Like that is a level of stress and pressure that nobody else ever feels in any other thing. But that doesn't mean that just because you've never reached that level, it might not be a good idea to have had some training in a tough spot previously in your life. So I've always thought that wouldn't be a bad little test.
But couldn't you instead, wouldn't it be awesome just to put them in like a locked room game then?
Yeah, that's all. Remember why I wrote that piece?
Yeah,
yes,
right.
A locked room game would be awesome for all the candidates. Yes. Oh,
watch
totally.
Watch them perform. That would be revealing.
So a locked room game, for those who don't know, is a series of puzzles that if you solve them, you get the clues to help you find the key to get you out of the locked
room. And teamwork is extremely important, at least in the one that we did in San Francisco.
Totally. It was so revealing about so many different things. And it's also, it is like having the Avengers, but not knowing what their nobody knowing what their skills are, because everybody sort of sorts to whatever their level and skill is. And it's very cool to watch, you know, who's the person who's really good at organizing, who's good at leading, who's good at, you know, focusing on like the fuzzy stuff, who can just do the math. Anyway,
John, are you interested, or David, in questions of politicians about when they changed their minds? I wrote about that recently regarding judges, but I think it's also relevant to, not to overprivilege changing your mind, because sometimes when you have a conviction, obviously it's all well and good to stick with it. But the kinds of facts or circumstances that lead a person to change his or her mind about something important, I find that really interesting.
Yeah,
totally agree.
But so I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, well, every politician now has one example they can do. So what I would say is they give you one example, and then you force them to give you
– because you think gay marriage is the obvious example?
What's the second
one? Well, I was going to – why don't just ask them the second one first. So like what's your second
–
what's the second most important decision? Although, see, here's the problem when you asked earlier about the fact that I get to ask these questions now. These are great – I think these questions, these big fuzzy ones, are best for – written questions, because it's not a gotcha. Like, tell me the toughest scrape you were in and how you got out of it. Take as long as you want. Make a PowerPoint. Use Claymation. Do whatever you need to convey to us that you were in a tough spot and here are the ways in which you arranged yourself to get out of it, or whatever you want to tell us that you got through. So if you do it in like a 5-minute interview on TV, they're going to like collapse. So I think these are all better asked. And also, like some of them, you kind of have to sit with that question for a minute in order for people to get why it's a great question.
Right, right. Emily, when we were batting this around before the show, you had some inchoate desire to talk about physical
I
don't know what you were talking
about. The way
you said
that
every candidate had to be able to do a pull-up, which seems so odd.
Why did I say that? That does seem so odd. I take it back. How did you lead me into that?
I don't know. I don't think you were led into it. I think you raised it autonomously.
Right.
Do you think there's any physical feat that is important?
No, of course not. I think that's actually silly. I mean, I stand by my notion that exercise has become like an acceptable outlet for excess energy. But no, I don't have any idea that maybe they should all have to swim. How about that?
Well, why?
I don't know. Just because knowing how to swim seems like an important life skill.
Yeah.
But I suppose the president's the last person who has to know to swim, because he would hardly or she would hardly be in danger from not being able to swim.
And also that would make them all look fit in the famous G8 swimming costume picture.
I don't think they should actually have to swim so much as maybe it would be good for us to know that indeed they can swim.
So, but, you know, there's an old book on presidential greatness that was written in like the 30s, and it went through every president, and it had a pretty cool kind of assessment and a criteria, you know, evaluation of each and why they were good. And each one had a health section and like evaluated the health of the president and whether they were healthy in office. And it basically was making the implicit in that categorization was the idea that like you need to be healthy to be able to do the job. And that's probably
I don't agree with that at all. I mean, maybe that's an early 20th century.
Well,
I don't think the evidence points to that. I mean,
well, no.
Franklin Roosevelt,
mean,
sure,
right.
Franklin Roosevelt, and
no,
Abe Lincoln,
and Abe
Kennedy
was sure.
also
sure,
very
sure, and
impaired.
Kennedy as well. Right. Well, you can make the, then fine to make the, then I think it's you could totally make the opposite case. So if it's true that Lincoln had 9 bouts of depression, then you know. Maybe that's a predictor of greatness.
They could have won the Civil War in 63.
Now, I think the Kennedy health stuff, I think
it does seem like it must have been an enormous distraction for him just because he was in so much pain.
Yeah. And also the drugs he was on and the constant duplicity that you had to have in your daily life is probably not great, although that's pretty true of many politicians. But what about like an interview question, David, that you ask people when you hire them?
Yeah. Well, the one interview question that I have found to be most useful in my recent round of hires, I used to ask kind of crazy questions like if Harry Potter had to face off against the Death Star, who would win? Like that, questions like that.
But so you could watch them think out loud, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes you get good answers with that. But actually, I think the person who gave me the best answer, if I remember, was somebody who actually probably wouldn't have been a good hire. But the question that I've had really great luck with recently is this is asking people who I'm about to hire. And I say, if you leave in 6 months from Atlas Obscura, why have you left? Like, what is it that's happened that's made you leave? And that has been super useful for me as an interview question. I don't know what the presidential analog is.
And it's useful because it's revealing, because people either answer by telling you something about themselves or about what would happen in the company that would
exactly.
make them want to
leave. Yeah, it tells them about what they really value.
Right.
And it tells you them about what they think the vision of the company should be. Sometimes it tells you something you don't even know about.
Seems most interesting to me is because if you ask somebody like, what are your ambitions? What do you hope to get out of it in 6 months? They'll give you some like straight ahead thing. But if you said, why will you have left? They convey a lot of that information, but in a slightly less guarded, or it seems to me, potentially less guarded way.
I hope no one's answer was that they came for your beard, David. What if that was like
unfortunately that
driving force?
And now they're leaving.
Can you imagine how great that would be if you were like hiring like comedy staff? If somebody said that, because you know the answers would be great. You know, be because our sex tape was finally released, or like you know the double homicide I will have committed. Well, I'll try and come up with some of these questions.
Let's see you work that into Face the Nation, baby. How many presidential candidates have you hit
what
so far?
What would lead you to leave the presidency after you've been elected?
Wait, what was that?
You had Bernie Perry, Christie.
Kasich, Santorum.
Oh, Santorum. We forgot about him. He's running. We didn't even mention him in our polling section.
I thought I did.
No.
No, that is just...
Have you had Huckabee?
What an oversight.
I did. I talked to Huckabee when I was guest hosting.
I can't wait to hear John Dickerson put some of these strategies into action. Send to our Facebook page, facebook.com/gabfest, or our Twitter feed, @SlateGabFest, questions that Dickerson should be asking. Maybe he'll...
And if you're going to do that, they have to pass the plausibility test, which is part of the challenge here. Well, the written questions can be multi-part and difficult, but part of the challenge with any question of anybody ever in a public setting is people think of what is the answer they want, and then they assume whatever question they ask is going to elicit that answer. But asking the question, it turns out, does not come with a sidecar of sodium pentothal.
That's right.
They don't automatically give you the answer just because you asked the question.
That is such a good point, John.
Yeah, that's a problem. That's one of the hardest things. That always makes me so nervous when I'm interviewing someone, just because you have limited time. And so you ask what you think is a great question, and then they just start filibustering. And it makes me sweat.
Yeah. Yeah, well, imagine doing that every Sunday.
That's why it's your job and not mine.
This episode of the Gabfest is brought to you by Sundance Now Doc Club, the new streaming service for everyone who loves documentaries. If you are like me and you like real stories, real people in extraordinary situations, and love to learn about the world around you, you will love the Sundance Now Doc Club. It is really awesome. There's a variety and intelligence to the documentaries that they've brought to the club that is tremendous. It has amazing amazing films that you just really want to see. You have also very intelligent curation. You have people like Ira Glass and Susan Sarandon and others who have made recommendations about things that they love. Dan Savage, Emily, your beloved Dan Savage, has a great set of recommendations and Doc Club. You're just going to find something. You're going to find many, 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 many films that you're going to want to see if you love documentaries. You also, as a Sundance Now Doc Club member, get exclusive benefits like free movie tickets, access to film festivals, award shows, and more. So this week, what am I recommending? I'm going to recommend a movie I actually did not love. I think I did this last week, in fact, too. But this is another documentary I didn't love, but which is very worth seeing for one aspect of it, which is Page One. Have you guys seen this? The New York Times documentary?
Yeah.
Seen it. Yeah, it's not a great documentary by any stretch. However, it has the late David Carr.
Who it's basically the David Carr story.
It's the David Carr story. So David Carr was this incredible columnist for the New York Times. He was an early boss of mine and an incredibly charismatic, interesting figure. And it's fascinating to watch David kind of storm through the world. There aren't a lot of newspaper superheroes these days, but David was as close as you can get to it. And Page One really has some memorable scenes of him. So you should go check that out. And there's a free 30-day trial for GabFest members. So you can get your free 30-day trial at docclub.com/GabFest. That's docclub.com/GabFest. Let's go to cocktail chatter. When you've finished watching your documentary for the week, Emily, it's time you're having a post-documentary beverage with your beloved family. What are you going to chatter to them about?
I have double chatter. They're related. Our friend Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's been a guest on the show a number of times, has a new book coming out. It's called Between the World and Me. And it is a very moving letter. It's a book written in the form of a letter that Ta-Nehisi wrote to his son, who's now 15. It's about being African American in this country. It's also just like about being American and the way in which this country's history should inform its present and its future. It's really thought-provoking and worth reading. And it was originally slated to be published in October, but the pub date got moved up, I think, to like next week because there have been just so many events rolling around that make this book relevant. So I wholeheartedly recommend it, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates. And then there was a study this week that is one facet of race in America that really struck me. It was a study of prosecutors, elected state and local prosecutors across the country. 95% of them turn out to be white, and 79% turn out to be white men. Many more white men than is the percentage of the whole country. I guess I shouldn't be surprised when I think about the elected prosecutors I know of. I can only think of a few women and a few people of color. But it's just such a striking disparity. And prosecutors have so much power. It's really important to think about the choices we're making when we elect them. And this study came from the Women Donors Network, an organization in San Francisco I'd never heard of before. But it was just a really good idea to spotlight these numbers. So we'll post a link.
The Ta-Nehisi book got a review in Slate this week that is one of the best reviews I've ever read of anything ever. Basically said, this is the most important book that you will read this year. So go out and read it. John Dickerson, what's your chatter?
My chatter is about the iconic photograph in Times Square from 1945 of a sailor kissing a nurse. Alfred Eisenstadt was the photographer. And it was, for a long time, has been considered that it was taken after the war, after World War II was officially over, which was announced at 7 p.m. on August 14th, 1945. But in a great story, in a great story in the L.A. Times, but in a great bit of sleuthing by a guy named Don Olson, he looked at the photograph and figured that, in fact, it was not taken at 7 o'clock in the evening or just after 7 o'clock in the evening. And this is interesting for journalistic ethic purposes because Life always presented it as having been taken after 7 o'clock, after the news was released. It's also kind of curious if it wasn't taken after 7 o'clock, how a man grabbed a nurse just in the middle of the street and kissed
her.
And what was causing. So
it was the 40s, Emily. Yeah. Times were different.
So here's a little bit about the story and how he figured this out. So he's done this before using astronomy to ground famous works of art. He did it with Ansel Adams's some of his Yosemite photograph. He did it with Vincent van Gogh's Moonrise. He also used it to figure out that the USS Indianapolis was especially vulnerable to a Japanese attack because there was a full moon behind it. So anyway, his sleuthing here started from hearing the story of a woman named Gloria Boulard, who was a 19-year-old nursing student in 1945. And she told her story of being in Times Square that day. And she's in the actual iconic photograph. She's seen grinning at the kissing couple. And in her story, she said, first of all, that she had been similarly kissed several times on her way home, but that she was walking home all the way to New Canaan, Connecticut. Then, and she said she got home to New Canaan around 7, but it takes like 2 hours for her to get there. So he started thinking, well, if her story is true and she got home when the news broke, that means when she was in the position to be smiling in the photograph, it must have been early. So then they notice in the photograph there's a clock, but the shorthand on the clock is too hard to figure out what time it is. So they then started to study the shadow on the Lowe's building. He studied Olson studied these pictures, hundreds of them, from Times Square at that period to try to figure out what kind of object was going to throw that kind of shadow. Only until you'd figured out the object could you figure out whether the light coming at it was going to cast a shadow of the specific kind that appears in the photograph. So he started to think, is it a water tower? And there was a water tower on the hotel next door, the Hotel Astor. But then it turns out there wasn't a water tower. And what he then discovered was that there was in one vintage photograph, he found an L-shaped sign advertising the rooftop garden. So he went and got went to Columbia University, got the blueprints, and it revealed that the L in the top of the sign was 18 feet wide, which was the perfect size to cast a 16-foot shadow on the building that was 100 feet away. So with that, he then was able to use spherical trigonometry and projective geometry, which, you know, as any fool would know, is the right thing to do, to discover exactly what time it would have been to cast that specific shadow. But then, because he was a thorough fellow, he went to his friend, Russell Doscher, I think is how you spell the name, to build a cardboard scale model of Times Square in the 1940s. And they then used a mirror to mimic the angle of the sun at 5:51 p.m. on that day, August 14th, 1945, in order to replicate what the shadow would have looked like. And that was when they said, bada bing, it looks exactly like we would have guessed it would look at 5:45. So it appears that that famous photograph, which was considered to have been taken at the precise moment after it was announced that peace was declared, or I shouldn't say peace is declared, but the war was over, turns out it happened, you know, maybe 2 hours earlier.
Here's a crazy thing. That guy who Olson, I sat next to him at dinner last weekend, two weekends ago.
Oh, my God.
Because he's married to an English professor. And the English professor is a friend of my mother's. They're in the Children's Literature Association, and they were giving my mother an award, and so I was at the table with him. I knew he did astronomy to solve. He figured out when Van Gogh's Starry Night was painted, what time that was.
Not in the daytime was my guess.
Weirdly, that Eisenstadt photo is amazing. That I wrote something about that Eisenstadt photo, which is that it appeared in Life in must be like late August issue of Life, 1945, mid-August issue of, and those 3 months of Life in 1945, which I wrote a story about, are just the most incredible set of things. Like that photograph, there's amazing stories that we still read today. It was the best magazine ever made at its best moment. My chatter is nothing so grand as that. I just want to recommend a book that I finished yesterday and was so sad to finish because it's one of the best books I've read in a long time. It's Station 11.
It's on my list.
Emily St. John Mandel. It's a post-apocalyptic book. It's beautiful, beautiful, beautiful book. And I think some of you who've listened to the show for a long time know that I have a kind of Jones about the road, which is a book that was so disturbing. I couldn't even – it's the book that most affected me I've ever read, but it also freaked me out more than any book I've ever read. Well, this book is a very similar kind of book to The Road, but it has a beauty and humanity to it that's really inspiring. You must read it if you
care about the human race.
If you care about the human race.
If you're a person.
It's a incredibly great book.
And it's the selection for the Slate Audiobook Club for this month, we should add.
Can I just say, if there is a genre called post-apocalyptic books, does that mean that every other book is in the genre of pre-apocalyptic books?
Yeah.
Realism, we call that.
The world's going to end, dude. One day the world will end. It may not be for a while. It's going to happen. Our intern is Tark Barrett. Our producer is Mike Volo. Our managing producer is Joel Meyer. Andy Bowers is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. The Gabfest is part of the Panoply Network. Check out our entire roster of podcasts at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page is slate.com/gabfest. Our Facebook page is facebook.com/gabfest. Our Twitter feed is @SlateGabFest. And subscribe to the Gabfest in iTunes. Search for Slate Political Gabfest in the iTunes store and leave a comment and rating. For Emily Bazelon and John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. We'll talk to you next week, and we'll see you, some of you, in D.C. in a few weeks. Bye-bye.